Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
Today's special episode is an interview with Robert Pike, wherein we discuss his new book, Silent Village, Life and Death in Occupied France, which is about Orador Serglon, which experienced a Nazi massacre in 1944. Robert Pike is currently a PhD student at Cardiff University. He graduated from the University of Exeter, where he studied history and French in 1998. His doctoral research is entitled An Interdisciplinary Approach to Rural Resistance in Nazi-Occupied France. He is also the author of two books about occupied France. The first of these, Defying Vichy, Blood, Fear, and French Resistance, tells the story of the origins of the resistance in the Dordogne, while his second book is the topic of today's episode. Please enjoy. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Robert. You have a very interesting book, which has just hit shelves, which is Silent Village, Life and Death in Occupied France, which tells a story that is, I think, pretty well known in France, but maybe not so much outside of France, because it's been overshadowed by the Holocaust and other atrocities committed in World War II. Can you please explain to us what happened at Orador Serglon?
Yeah, thanks, Gary. Yeah, so it's interesting you say that it's probably not that well known. I think in, like you say, in France, it is very, very well known. And I think it's one of those places that's almost a bit of a rite of passage when you go to France. A lot of English and American, German people go there sort of on their way south on holiday. But what happened was that just after D-Day, so D-Day was the 6th of June, 1944, and this was the 10th of June, 1944, which was a Saturday morning, and in France and. In those days, all the kids were at school, and it's a pretty much a normal working day. But the SS Panzer Division Das Reich, or an element of it, was sent into this village, Orador. And it's important that we think about Orador as being not just a village. In French they call it a commune. So it's lots of little villages and hamlets around it as well. It's kind of the central bourg. The villages were rounded up, and the people in the fields sort of around it, and then the farms around. And after a short wait, it was probably a couple of hours actually, when the population were told that these soldiers had reason to believe that there were arms hidden in somewhere in the village, then the men and the women were divided up. The women and the children were taken to the church, where they were locked in, and the men into these six areas. There were barns and hangars and warehouses and things, and that's when the place was or the people were massacred. So we think within about half an hour of each other that first of all the men were shot, and then afterwards lots of combustible materials were put on top of them, and they were set on fire. And then in the church, a box was brought into the church, and again the doors were closed, but this box was lit, and out of it came this acrid smoke, and kind of asphyxiated a lot of the people. There was panic, and then the Germans sort of came into the church. I say the Germans, I've got to be careful saying the Germans actually, because I'll come back to that in a bit, but it wasn't just German soldiers there. It was, you know, SS soldiers came in and fired at the remaining people, and then again the church was set on fire. So, you know, it was a complete massacre of this town's population. And from that church, one woman managed to escape through a window, and from one of the barns, about, I think it was six men escaped miraculously, one of whom is still alive as we speak now. But well, I suppose we'll come back to why it happened. But it was what the French tend to call now a sort of crime gratuit. So it was a little bit unexplained as to why it happened, other than it was a show of force, really, to the population that they had to not support the resistance that was happening in that part of France at that moment, particularly with D-Day having, you know, recently happened. So in a nutshell, that's kind of what happened, and I suppose we'll go into a little bit more depth a little bit later, I suppose, yeah.
Absolutely. Your book is about the massacre, but it is much more than that. You detail what this village was like before World War II. You've touched on it a little bit, how it was more than just a village. You even go back and make some forays into its medieval past. Can you tell us, in as much detail as you like, what this commune, this village was like?
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, this is a village that had been there for 1,000 years. And, you know, actually, it's not even the first kind of massacre that had taken place there. There had been, you know, during the Wars of Religion, there'd been something which I don't have a lot of detail about, but there had been a kind of a battle there, and the village that some of the villagers had been killed at that time. But yeah, so this is a normal Limousin village. So it's about, I suppose, 12 miles or so west of Limoges. So we're talking just south of central France, I suppose, if you want to say that. Not that far from Bordeaux, and kind of on the way to Clermont-Ferrand if you go that way. So it was a normal village. It's a very, even though the city of Limoges is quite nearby, in fact, there was a tram that went between the two places. Even though it was very close to that, you were into the countryside, and it was a very sort of rural environment. A very agricultural place. I wouldn't say it was a particularly poor village for that part of France, and the reason is because of that tram. It had good links to a city, so that there were five tram lines that came out from Limoges, and so what that meant was villagers could go into the city to work. Almost, I suppose, like a commuter town these days. The farmers could go in and sell their wares in the city, in the marketplaces, and people then from the city could come out to this village, and they did on the weekends. You know, it was a pleasant place to go, and there were some nice hotels and restaurants and cafes and bars and things there. So it was quite well known for being a nice place to go on the weekends, and people used to take the tram and travel out and go fishing in the Glan. They used to go swimming in the Glan. It had a good sort of mix of shops. Most of the, you know, the services for that particular community were all based in the central bourg of Oradour. And some, you know, reasonably big places nearby, Saint-Junien, just down the road as well. It had everything you probably would need, really. You wouldn't need to go very far out of Oradour. It had bakers, and it had patisserie, it had several butchers, it had a post office and a tramway station, you know, and even banks and places where you could buy agricultural materials, places where you could buy fuel, and several garages. So it really was it wasn't a very, very poor place. But at the same time, we were just at that point where farmers would living around the village. A lot of them were tenant farmers, so they kind of would change farm every year or a couple of years, and it was about kind of just making enough to get by those farmers that lived just outside the village. And really, within Ojodo itself, there were some buildings that were a little bit more sort of bourgeois. So it was a real mix. It was a real mix of people. And politically, there were two, I suppose, political characters that lived there. One was called Joseph Beau, and he was a socialist. And a conservative called Desotto, Paul Desotto. Paul Desotto came from a line of kind of a bourgeois line of, they were all doctors, and he had been mayor a couple of times, but he'd never actually been elected. He kind of got passed down when his father died. Whereas people tended to prefer the socialist list, and actually Joseph Beau, who owned a grocery shop, was quite popular. So when he got the chance to be elected, actually easily won the election. And then when Paul Desotto went off to fight, and then he kept sort of beating him in elections. And then there was this time when in 1941, when Pétain had come to power, when really they found an excuse to move him out, really, and put Paul Desotto back into power. So there was this kind of strain. There was this socialist, I think it was more of a socialist place, but like a lot of places in France at this time, there was an element of conservatism which was always there, and I guess where the money lied. A mix of a lot of different types of people in this one little place.
After the Germans destroyed the village, de Gaulle ordered its ruins left alone, and it became an embodiment of a typical French village that symbolized France's ordeal during the war. Now, you've touched on this a bit, but you argue that it was not necessarily the standard French village. Can you explain why?
Yeah, I mean, that's something I didn't say at the start, actually, was this decision to maintain this wreck, this empty shell of a village, which was a decision made by de Gaulle. And I think there's a lot of different theories as to why, you know, he did this, but he was trying to bring this representation of what France had endured, as you said in the question. Everything that France had been through was going to be kind of represented as being a martyrdom. There were some awkward questions after the war. Certainly, communism was doing relatively well, and de Gaulle needed to put a lid on that. And he needed to demonstrate or to show to the world that France had suffered in this occupation. And he didn't want to sort of dwell on any of the idea that there had been collaboration or some of the things that we learned about during the 70s and 80s. He obviously didn't want to dwell on that. So this idea of a martyr was, I suppose, there's something religious about it. And I personally, I don't particularly like the idea of this being a martyred village. You know, this was a village which happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, you know, and there were all sorts of people living in this village, and some, yes, you could say, well, they were all doing things that could mark them out as a martyr in future. Some not, you know, some were not particularly well behaved, let's say, during the occupation, and then there were the vast majority, like in the middle, doing what they could just to get by. So martyrdom is for me a strange kind of use of the term, and it's still described as you know, le village martyr when you arrive there. But what he wanted to show, you know, this kind of worked quite well for him. This idyllic place. There were lots of postcards that existed in Ojodo prior to the massacre, you know, and it showed a very nice, very French normal place. And like I said, it didn't have a bad economy for a village of its size. It was you know, relatively prosperous with some really nice, I forgot to say, some really nice restaurants, really well-known restaurants. People used to come there for this kind of thing. But did it symbolize France's ordeal during the war? This is kind of the point. It did in a way, because it was just a normal, you know, I kind of took this with this book. Halfway through it, it takes almost half the book to actually get to the massacre, because I'm really looking at this kind of cross section of society and looking at what was there, you know. And yeah, I wouldn't argue against the idea that it is a normal, or it was a normal place. You know, it was fairly normal, fairly well to do. Did it represent a typical French village, however, as people might have seen before the war, or might imagine a typical French village to be? No, because during the occupation period, a heck of a lot had changed in Oradour. There had been a huge influx of refugees and evacuees. All sorts of things changed during that period. So lives changed and the political landscape changed. The ways people made their money changed. Although I wouldn't say it wasn't a typical French village, because I think everywhere changed, I would have said that it was potentially used as this idyllic place. And like anywhere in France, if you kind of pick it apart, you'll find a sort of you'll find the sort of unsavory elements that were there, just like anywhere else.
Your book is a number of things. It is a story of Oradour, but it is also something of a biography of four individuals you interviewed: Robert Ibra, André Desorteau, Camille Senon, and Albert Vallade. Can you tell us about these people?
Well, when I went to Oradour, I went a number of times to try and write this. I was helped by various members of staff at the Centre de la Mémoire in Oradour-sur-Glane. And I said, yeah, I knew of this one particular person who'd escaped the actual shootings themselves, and that was Robert Ibra. He's written a number of books, and if you've been to Oradour, you'll have picked up something with his name on or his photo. So I knew about Robert Ibra, and I was aware he was still alive. I'd first been to Oradour back in 1993, so you know I was quite surprised to find out he was still alive. But I asked someone called Sandra Gibouin, who helped me at the Centre de la Mémoire. She and I sort of said, "Do you think you could set up an interview?" And I was thinking, well, he's probably fed up now of meeting people and talking about his experiences. And she said, "Yeah, no problem. I can get an interview with him." You know, and in the meantime, what about these other people? So I was thrilled to be able to meet these other people. And what was interesting about it is that, well, first of all, André Desorteau, if you walk the main street of Oradour-sur-Glane, you'll see that it's the Rue Émile Desorteau. Now, that was André Desorteau's great-grandfather, sorry. What's interesting about him is I mentioned Joseph Beau, the socialist, and who had been mayor, and Paul Desorteau, who is André's, Desorteau's grandfather. The fact that these two were political rivals didn't particularly like each other at all. They really didn't. And André Desorteau's grandfather, Paul, had five sons, I think. And one of those sons turned out to have had a relationship with Joseph Beau's daughter. She fell pregnant. This was kind of a big scandal in Oradour-sur-Glane. So much of a scandal that what would have been, you know, if a Desorteau getting married, you know, would have been a big society event. But this couple in a kind of Romeo and Juliet scenario were sent off to live in Limoges to have the baby and get married quietly in Limoges. And that child was André Desorteau. And they were able to come back to Oradour when they were married and they were having their second child, a sister. So very interesting to be able to talk to André Desorteau, because I knew about him, but I didn't know that he was still alive. And again, I was able to go and meet him and his wife and spend the afternoon. And the man is encyclopedia, you know, he's like an encyclopedia of this village. And then you had Camille Saint-Sinon. Again, I knew about her, although I hadn't put two and two together, because people in France at this time used to use different names. She's actually Marguerite, but she went by the name of Camille, and I'd kind of seen her testimony, and so I put them together. And I went and met her. Sandra very kindly arranged the interview, and it was very, very moving. She's an amazing woman. And what she had been on one of the trams that had arrived in Oradour as the massacre was taking place, because her family lived in Oradour. She lived in Limoges during the week and came back to Oradour in the on the weekend evening, just to have, you know, some family time. And she was one of a group of people who were lined up next to a hole that was being dug, and they were basically told that was for them. This mass grave was going to be for them. And for some strange reason, later on that evening, after a long, long wait, they were let go. So she had an interesting perspective on life kind of between Limoges and Oradour. And then we had Albert Vallade, who unfortunately died, I think it was December 2019 he died. But his again, slightly different viewpoint was he was the son of a tenant farmer in one of these little hamlets around Oradour. And he had this amazing knowledge about all the different people in these villages. And he, on that day, had been just outside the village when he had been with his cows, tending the cows in the field, and a piece of paper kind of, but there were bits and ash falling at his feet. And one of these pieces of paper was from one of the catechism books that they used at the church. And he knew, you know, he could see that this was true. The church was burning. He lost his sister, had gone into Oradour to try and pick up two of her four children. And he lost, she never returned, and neither did those children. So we had this wide range of experiences. Coming back to Robert Ebrard as well, you know, he's written down his experience of the day of being shot and of escaping the fires, and just an amazing escape with these five other people. This escape lasted all day. You know, he was in a terrible state when he, you know, finally got away. But again, he lost sisters, his mother, and but I'd heard his story a lot. And so what was interesting was sitting down with him and talking to him about life before. And again, he was someone who had, he was working in Limoges and kind of coming back to Oradour just on the weekends, and he shouldn't have been there that day. He was one of the very few who was quite laid back about the Germans arriving, because he had lots of experience with them. So there were four really interesting people with different viewpoints. And, you know, unfortunately, these people are disappearing. You know, we've lost Albert Vallade already. And, you know, it's great to sort of get their view of things down while we still can, really.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Let's start with the war. France falls and Oradour is part of Vichy under Marshal Petain. How did the war change life?
It changed a lot. This is perhaps where people can get this misconception when they go into Oradour and they see that, you know, they learn about the places and what was there, you know, that there was restaurants and hotels and things like that. I mean, firstly, even those hotels before the war, they weren't necessarily full of holidaymakers like they would be now. They were called Hôtel de Voyageurs, so they were basically full of tradesmen trying to sell things like sewing machines and things. But putting all that to one side, what you had in France at this moment, and we kind of have to track back just before the war, is you had these waves of newcomers to the region. This is something I'm researching at the moment, actually. And just before a war broke out, the government put into place that that there was going to be this evacuation of Alsace-Lorraine, or certain parts of Alsace-Lorraine, particularly around Strasbourg. And so you had a lot of people coming south, and through this amazing, I have to say, the administration of it was amazing, considering you had no computers and things like that. A lot of people came south, and Oradour, and all the villages around were sort of allocated a village or a couple of villages to have people living, you know, and they whether there was any free accommodation in hotel rooms, or the ballrooms of the hotels were filled up with sort of mattresses, and people's homes, you know, people had to just have people in their homes living. And so these people came to Oradour, and so you had that first of all. Now lots of those people then could go back when after France fell, they could go back to their original homes, and a lot did. But the people that were left behind primarily were Jewish people, and this part of France just hadn't really come across very many Jewish people, but certain families stayed behind because of that. But then you had a second wave, because France had fallen. During that period, you had a lot of people coming from all over: Roubaix, Paris, all sorts of, you know, kind of Avignon and places like this, where people were coming. You had a family coming over from Bayonne a little bit later, and looking for somewhere away from the war, because geographically Oradour is a long way from where the fighting was going on. So people had ended up there, and again a lot of people went back, some people stayed, a few people stayed, you know, a minority. And then tracking back even further, even before the outbreak of the war, 1936-38, you'd had quite a lot of Spanish people come in there, Spanish people who had come over from sort of fleeing Franco's kind of march northwards. And again, it's another different story, really, but a lot of Spanish had been interned, and then there were these sort of camps, they called them MGTE, Groupement de Travail Étranger. And these were camps which Spanish people would put into, and their families sort of followed them. And then it was kind of like forced labor. Sometimes Jews were put into them a bit later as well. And there was one of these actually in Oradour, just literally half a kilometer outside. So you'd had these people coming as well. And you also had then, you had people, a second wave of Alsace-Lorraine from the Moselle region. And these were people, when that area was annexed, well, not exactly annexed, but it was kind of occupied by the Nazis. Anyone, the Francophone elements of those areas were sent away, they were expelled. And again, they were given a place to go to. They were told head south and go to this place. And we had another wave of people arriving from two villages, this time in the Moselle. And this time these people, you know, were given no clue that they'd ever be able to go back. And so these were there sort of permanently. And we ended up then having a school built for these refugees. So as well as men going off to fight, we had some people in prisoner of war camps. So you had a kind of a change of the population. Then you had restrictions coming in as the war kind of progressed, or the occupation, I should say, progressed, and the war elsewhere went on, and Germany continued to fight. The arrangement between Pétain and Hitler was that this was going to be a kind of collaboration in terms of like a partnership. But as it turned out, you know, Hitler had no plans of that type. France was going to be a store cupboard, you know, for the Reich. So life just got harder. Food got harder to come by. You know, you had things like rationing, problems with, so for example, a lot of, as well as the arable farming, there's a lot of sort of meat produced, cow meat in this part of France. A lot of those sort of beasts were being sent off to Germany, so it was really hitting the economy. Plus all these restaurants and cafes and places like that, you know, the restaurants had to close because they couldn't run, and also the hotels were full of refugees. You know, all they could do was just kind of keep ticking along. Pétain announced when the war ended, and collaboration, this period of collaboration started, that dancing was no longer allowed. You know, people had to sort of mourn France's defeat. So things really changed quite rapidly. And strangely enough, in Ordor, the food thing wasn't such an issue as it was in the cities. In the cities, in the big shops, things disappeared from the shelves. Whereas in these villages, you had farmers nearby. And actually, those farmers around the outside of these villages actually started to thrive because they could just produce a little bit more of what they'd been producing before. And you had clandestine kind of butchering of meat, and you had food available in these villages that perhaps you couldn't get elsewhere. So that meant that people started to come out to villages and to try and get things for that reason, which is why there were quite a few people from outside of Ordor there that Saturday. They weren't there to play for pleasure seeking purposes. They were there to try and get food.
On the 11th of November, 1942, Germany occupied Vichy, France, and squeezed the country to support its war against the USSR. How did this second phase change Oradour?
Do you know what? I don't think it did change Oradour very much at all. I don't think it really affected Oradour. Strangely, you talk to any of the survivors, and the only time that anyone had seen a German soldier in Oradour prior to the massacre was that night, the 11th of November 1942, when one of the main roads ran fairly close to Oradour, and apparently some soldiers passed through. Other than that, no one saw any soldier in Oradour during the occupation period. No soldier, no Gestapo, no milice. People just didn't see them. They didn't come to these places. People like Robert Hébrard and Camille Senon had experience of seeing people in Limoges, some of the bigger towns where the German kind of, Limoges being a very big place, actually, there were a lot of Germans in Limoges, and there were some kind of satellite posts elsewhere in the Dordogne, in the Dordogne and Limousin and or Vienne, places like that. But a place like this, like Oradour-sur-Glane, no one saw any soldiers. What did change, though, after that period, was that Germany realized they needed more men, more manpower, because, you know, they had this second front they'd opened up, and they needed, obviously they invaded the USSR, and then they started to realize that they needed a lot more kind of military manpower. So their manpower was going to the military, and then they realized they needed manpower for their factories and things. So there was this negotiation between the Vichy government, Laval in particular, and of trying to get Frenchmen to go, and women actually, but primarily Frenchmen of a certain age to go and work in Germany. And it started off as something called Le Relève, which was a kind of a swap where you get one prisoner of war back for three volunteers who went off and worked in Germany. And it just didn't work, you know. It didn't work because people didn't want to go, but also because the people that they were sending back were generally people who were ill, and they were not going to be very good for the French economy anyway. So a new thing was negotiated, which was called STO, which is Service de Travail Obligatoire. And this was kind of a tranche of the young men of France, of what was the occupied zone prior to that. And this was February 1943, so a year after Le Relève had been launched. And this now was no longer this is no longer kind of a volunteer thing. This is obligatory. So at this point, young men started to hide. And we know that in Oradour-sur-Glane on the day of the massacre, there were a number of men hiding out. They survived, apart from one of them. So you had that happening. And what this also did was we'd had the formation of this resistance happening. Now, the resistance started off as kind of a political thing. It wasn't really the only armed resistance groups were based around former kind of soldiers that had been decommissioned in out in forests and things like that. But suddenly you had a lot of men who were hiding out and needed something to do or wanted to respond in some way. So you had these what became known as Maki groups, the sort of the guerrilla fighters, the guerrilla resistance. And you had you had communist Maki, FTP, and then you also had these Gaullist Maki. And at this point, you were getting more men going to the Maki than the Maki could kind of handle or feed or arm. So that, I think, affected France, this part of France, more than the occupation did. Because like I say, you wouldn't see a German soldier unless you went into a large town or a city. And they were being well behaved at that point. Things were getting requisitioned, vehicles were getting requisitioned, fuel was running out, people were having to use bicycles, and even then bicycle tires started to run out. So things were changing, but it was all stuff which, you know, didn't have a huge impact on people's lives. What did impact on people's lives was when, you know, your older brother or your son was suddenly called up and expected to go and work in Germany.
On the 10th of June, 1944, the SS division Das Reich arrived at Oradour-sur-Glane. What happened that day?
So what had been going on was in the region around this part of France was being nicknamed La Petite Russie, Little Russia, because it was there was so much of this kind of guerrilla fighting which had started up by that point, and the soldiers not just the Das Reich but lots of different battalions were being attacked and things, and guerrilla fighters, you know, they wouldn't face an army full on. What they would do is they'd attack from behind and retreat into the trees. So there was this kind of stuff going on. You also had at this point, because you'd had D-Day, certain towns and smaller towns were, you had Maki groups, particularly the communist groups, because the communists just wanted to get on with fighting, whereas the Gaullist groups were being told, they were more organized, they were being told to wait until you're told to act. But in some of the towns in this part of the world, Guéret, Toul, you had examples of communist groups going in and trying to, and very briefly liberating these smaller places, because what had been left behind there were just sort of centuries of Wehrmacht, older, not such elite troops. So they were easily overcome. But then in the south, in around the Montauban region, you had this beast waiting. It was the SS Das Reich division, and this enormous division had been fighting in Eastern Europe and where it carried out all sorts of atrocities. Now, it had also suffered a lot of losses, and it was waiting in this southern part of France to know what to do next. A lot of new recruits had been trained up in the Bordeaux area, and they were kind of joining. And a lot of these recruits, it has to be said, not only were they very young, but a lot of them weren't coming from Germany, they were coming from France. So a lot of them were forced conscripts from Alsace-Lorraine, you know, from France. So this division was being brought together to be a comparable strength to what it had been before. Machinery, transport was being fixed. And then it was given orders. Now, a misconception is that the Das Reich was told quickly, you know, we've had D-Day, get to Normandy as quickly as you possibly can. And this was the understanding for quite a long time, and that the resistance had this really good kind of record of slowing them down. But actually what they were told is, make your way north, but we want you to deal with this problem area of France first. So in these places that have been liberated by the communist groups, suddenly you had these kind of almost firefighting little battalions from the Das Reich being sent in and quelling these problems. So in Toul, the day before the Oradour massacre, that had been liberated. Das Reich arrived and won the town back. And 99 men were hanged from lampposts. Another 150-odd was deported just because of what had happened in Toul as reprisals. In a place called Guéret, you had a similar thing had happened. So again, Das Reich sent in. That was quelled. 22 young Maquisards fighters were brutally murdered. And so this kind of thing was happening a lot. And the Das Reich was trying to put down these little insurrections. And they were dealing with this. They were going to try and hit hard before going north. So this order had come out that somewhere had to be hit hard. And this has been kind of contested ever since. But the order's there in black and white. You know, somewhere was going to suffer and was going to be made an example of, as had been the way the things were done in Eastern Europe. So a place was chosen. And again, there are arguments about why Oradour was chosen. Personally, I think it's fairly clear. There was a little bit of an insurrection in Saint-Junien, which is just down the road, a slightly bigger place. And so the Das Reich were kind of sent there, or elements of it. And that was easily dealt with. And I think the idea might have been that they were going to do this to Saint-Junien. Now, I think when they got there, they realized Saint-Junien was a bit too big for that. So they called in some local sort of miliciens, kind of local French policemen, if you like, and they had meetings. And I think this is perhaps the point at which someone French along the way probably pointed out that this place, Oradour-sur-Glane, it's going to be easy to surround. It's just about the right size. There's no Maquis nearby. There's no resistance known to be in Oradour-sur-Glane. So you shouldn't be getting any fight back at all. You can do it calmly and gently. And that's what they did. They set off just after lunch and as I said earlier on, surrounded the place, arrested, or did this very calm roundup, got people into this village, onto this village green, and then they carried out the massacre as I described before. And then the place was set alight. Anyone who came and tried to sort of collect their children or whatever, they were killed on the spot. Some cyclists who were passing through, they were killed too. The German High Command did was they made sure that the person on the ground commanding the operation was a bit of a nutcase in terms of he just seemed to like this kind of operation. And fortunately, he got killed in Normandy a few weeks later, and so they had their perfect scapegoat. You know, they started blaming him for what had happened in Oradour. He went above and beyond his orders, but there's no real evidence of that. But what people don't tend to know as well is that it didn't kind of end on that one day. Sentries were left there so that people couldn't get back, and then over the next sort of 48 hours. Soldiers kept coming back and making sure, burning down any places that had been left over, disposing of any bodies that were lying in the street. This is where, and anyone who's been to Oradour will know about this, you know, bodies were found in ovens and down a well and things like that. It was probably at that point that these bodies were disposed of in that way. And this is the really heartbreaking thing. The point of the destruction of Oradour, as far as I can see, was to actually erase not just the buildings of this place, but this whole community. So they wanted to make sure that none of these remains were identifiable. So they actually made these, again, the fires, these horrible fires. They then transferred these bodies into mass graves. And they did that before they let any villagers into the village to try and reclaim their loved ones. So it wasn't something that lasted for 12, 24 hours. It lasted for several days before anyone could start making sense of this. And more people arrived than we perhaps we know that six got out of the barn. One woman got out of the church. She was a grandmother. A miraculous escape. There were others that had been hiding out. People who knew that they were kind of perhaps under surveillance by Vichy for being communist or for being Jewish or whatever. And some people had fled. So we had probably had about 20 or 30 other survivors. But generally, everyone who was rounded up pretty much was killed. So 643 people from Alsace-Lorraine, French, Spanish, Italian. We had all sorts of people there on that day. And there was no checking of identity documents. There was no, if you're a collaborator, you're going to be okay. You know, the Desotto mayor, who was a Pétanis, there was no distinction made. You know, they all suffered the same fate. And the idea was that there would be no witnesses.
History is complicated. The story of human progress is long, messy, and riddled with controversies big and small. On Conflicted, we dive headfirst into history's most infamous events and contentious figures. We try and untangle the good from the bad, the fact from the fiction, and the monsters from the misunderstood. Was Genghis Khan a murderous butcher or a civic pioneer? Did the Allied powers go too far in firebombing the German city of Dresden at the twilight of World War II? And how did the Marquis de Sade acquire such a sinister reputation? And was any of it true? These are just a few of the tough questions we wrestle with and investigate on Conflicted. So if you love history or just enjoy a good story, please join me, your host, Zach Cornwell, for a fascinating new topic each and every month. Conflicted, a history podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I hope to see you soon.
Afterwards, there were a number of important trials and inquiries of Germans and French collaborators. Who was held accountable for the massacre?
This is something which goes into a long story, but essentially no one was made accountable for Hodor. What the Germans tried to say was that this person, Adolf Dieckmann, who had been in charge on the ground on the day, was the person that had kind of gone above what he'd been told to do. So he was made into a bit of a scapegoat, and the Das Reich closed ranks. You know, they're very much kind of, this is our story, we'll pretty much stick to it. They hadn't quite got their story right at that point, because some of the soldiers on the day had said that they thought, you know, this was because a major had been kidnapped nearby, and that bit was true, but it was a major, but that happened a long way away from all, actually, and that didn't really contribute to what happened on the day. So, but anyway, there were various little stories like that going around, or that there had been arms discovered in Ordor, or that, you know, there had been some soldiers killed just outside Ordor. So these things were going around, and we know that the Germans hadn't got their, the Das Reich hadn't got this story straight at that point. But then they closed ranks, and they stuck to this story that it was Dieckmann who was responsible, who'd kind of gone above his order. And then over time, certain people have been taken prisoner. So some German prisoners were identified as having been in Hodor, and also some of these Alsace-Lorraine men who had been there on the day, because a lot of the firing had been done by men who were French, who were from Alsace-Lorraine. And this started to cause problems, because they organized this trial, that would eventually take place in Bordeaux in 1953. And what this was, it was a military tribunal. So whoever they'd identified and actually had in their grasp already were brought to trial on that day, on that week. And unfortunately, the investigators did identify who was further up the chain of command, but they were out of reach. They had gone back to Germany. And we know that, for example, the general commander of the Das Reich, General Lammerding, became a wealthy industrialist I can't remember which, I think it was Dusseldorf, perhaps, but one of the German cities, and lived a long life afterwards, and as was the case with the other commanders, the people high up. So the people who were tried in Bordeaux were actually they were the foot soldiers. And this is kind of the tragic thing about that trial. Now, during the trial, there were all sorts of legality and sort of legal arguments going on as to how this was going to go forward, because people in Alsace-Lorraine were really unhappy about this trial taking place, because they were saying, well, these people who were being tried, these boys, as they were 17 or 18-year-old boys when all of it happened. Now, regardless of the fact that they fired, they were there because they were forced to be there. They fired because if they didn't fire, they would have been shot themselves, or they had to join the SS because otherwise their families would be deported. And this group of men, or across the board, people who had been forced into the SS were called Malgré nous, which kind of translates as despite us. And it created a real tension between Alsace-Lorraine and the people of the Limousin. So during this trial, these men that had been brought, they were all sentenced. Only one man from Alsace-Lorraine joined of his own accord, and he was proved of having killed people, and he was given a longer sentence. Some of the Germans had slightly longer sentences, and they were all sentenced. In fact, so some of them were sentenced, including this one from Alsace-Lorraine, were sentenced to death, actually. And then most of them had kind of long prison sentences. But then there was such an uproar in Alsace-Lorraine over the course of several days, really. It only took days that the Parliament, the Assemblée Nationale, voted to kind of commute the sentences. And anyone who'd be sentenced to death, it was a reduced life imprisonment, or, a lot of these men then had their sentences turned over because they'd already been held for long enough that they didn't need to serve any more time. And this created a huge... So Alsace-Lorraine had been incredibly angry, and now the people of the Limousin were very angry because these were the only people to whom they were, were having justice served upon them, but this was being taken away from them. Whereas, and we knew that the people who were really commanded this were being protected in Germany, because France had made this policy, you could not... In fact, it was Germany, really, but it was an accord, this kind of in the interest of Entente. You weren't going to be sending these people for war crime offences. So even though General Lammerding was sentenced to death, it was in absentia. He was in Germany, and he was never going to be sent to France for trial. This went on for years. And in fact, when Lammerding died, and I found this in the archives just a couple of weeks ago, the French papers had to publish a photograph of him, of his body on a deathbed, to prove to the people of Limousin that he was actually dead, and that he hadn't just been kind of, whisked off to an even better life. So there was a real feeling, and there remains a real feeling, that really no one really was made to suffer for what happened on this day. And it came under the umbrella of, the Germans kind of almost... The rules of war was that reprisals were allowed. So what happened in Toul the night before, when the 99 men were hanged from lampposts, was legal in the rules of war. Oradour, as long as it was a reprisal, was, I suppose, although it was over the top, the Germans wanted to keep this narrative that it had been a legal act of war. And so they had to stick to their story. And we know that it wasn't. It was a war crime, as this division had conducted elsewhere in Europe. So it, a very unsatisfactory element. And even now, you know, you speak to Robert Ebois and he's still sad that no one has been made to pay. There was one other trial in 1983 in Berlin, a guy called Heinz Barth, who'd been a little bit further up the command. And he had, again, had been living in West Berlin. And he'd been kind of protected in the interest of Entente. And they tried him and he was given a long sentence. But again, he got out after about 10 years and died in his bed, which made people in this part of France incredibly angry.
One thing you touch on is how Oradour is not fixed in history, but is consistently rediscovered. What does Oradour mean today?
Someone who's been dealing with this a lot is someone called Hannah Diamond, who was responsible for the recent displays in the Musée Jean Moulin in Paris. She was talking to me about this the other day. The idea of the museum is kind of changing. And Oradour kind of changes in that way. The kind of the scrapbook type museum has become something where a narrative needs to be told, because the people who were there at the time and could stand in that museum and could talk you through what life was like are not there anymore. And suddenly people have to be able to find their way through the story. Now, a similar thing has happened in Oradour. When you used to go there, even when I went there, as a teenager in the early 90s, you still had guides that were taking people around, and the fact that they linked their own story to these surroundings, they could talk about what was there in front of people. There was a sort of materiality to it. There was a you could almost touch the story. And I think now that those last people have gone, and Robert Ebois up until last year was still taking people around, you know, groups of children. And I think groups of children who got that experience had a very different experience to groups of children who were just shown around or just looked around and tried to follow the signs and the guidebooks. So I think now we've got this same thing. In 1999, an exhibition centre was opened in Oradour, which tries to tell the story leading up to the massacre and what then happened on the day. So whereas if you'd visited in the 1960s or 70s, you would still have seen the sewing machines and the rubble, if you like. Now the place, I always think, and people have argued with me on this, but I think it sort of looks more like a sort of medieval, you know, if you've been to a castle in Wales, you'll see the same thing, you know, kind of recognizable buildings, but with a lot of grass over, you know, having overgrown it. So I think it's losing that sense of materiality, and you have to go into like a little crypt by the cemetery to see what I think are the really interesting things, which are the little watches that stopped and, you know, the toys that were gathered and the as I said, the sewing machines and the money that and the wallets, you know, you could easily miss that. So I think in terms of the visitor to the site, and I know that now Oradour, the Centre de la Mémoire, is reorganizing its visit to try and bring some of that materiality back in to show what life was like, so that it doesn't look too much like a medieval kind of site. It's still very shocking, don't get me wrong, because it's very recognizable what things are. But this is kind of my own thinking, that it is going to continue to overgrow, and the rust on the car and things like that is going to continue to sort of degrade the place. It can't last forever as it is. In terms of its place in the historiography, if you like, I think that's slightly different again. And I think it lived this life as the village martyr that de Gaulle wanted. It represented that place it represented the rest of France as being the one place that had suffered under this Nazi oppression and had given its own life. But I think now that the resistance, the occupation period has been reassessed, you know, I think it's time to sort of give these people their kind of names back rather than having this collective martyrdom. You know, I think it's an opportunity to sort of say, well, you know, these people lost their lives that day. Let's know a bit more about who they are. And the Centre de la Mémoire have started doing that by having a kind of gallery of photographs. It's kind of what I wanted to do with this book, was to try and reconstitute what this village was. You know, I take you through the massacre as well, but I kind of feel like the massacre, you know, that event means a lot more when you understand who these people were and what they were doing and why they were doing it. And I think really, it needs to move on from being a place of pilgrimage, if you like, for this martyrdom, to a place of learning. You know, yes, we can learn about the war and we can learn about the occupation and we can learn about what happened there on that day, and that mustn't be forgotten, don't get me wrong. But I think we also can use it as a place. I like to think of it as, you know, a place frozen in time, a bit like Pompeii. You know, how much have we learned about Roman times by looking at Pompeii? And as we've lost this, as we're losing these last few people who are able to talk about what life was like in that at that moment in time, then I think Ojodor can serve that purpose too. And we can see, you know, for example, there's buildings there. You know, do we know a puisatier? You know, someone used to dig wells. You know, where you've got the sabotier, which is the person who used to make the clogs. You know, there's a lot we can learn about just what life was like. The Charon, the wheelwright who used to make the wheels for the wagons. And then you've also got the fact that it can teach us a lot about Vichy France, because we can know that this family were this sort of family. This was a Jewish family. This was a family from the Moselle. This is links to the evacuation. This is a family who came from Roubaix, and they came during another time. This girl had been sent from Paris to be safe during the war. So by giving them their names back, we can kind of understand what was going on in this place as well. And it can teach us a lot more, because it was a fairly typical place, but it can teach us a lot more about what life in Vichy France was really like. Does that answer your question?
I think it does. Thank you very much for being on the show. The book is Silent Village, Life and Death in Occupied France. This has been enlightening.
Thank you.
As always, donations keep the podcast going. So if you would like to make a one-time donation or become a patron, please consider doing so. Thank you very much for your continued support.
Welcome to Anthology of Heroes, the podcast that explores the most pivotal moments of history through the eyes of those who lived it. In this podcast, we don't spend our time recounting facts and dates. Instead, we follow in the footsteps of national heroes, kings, or ordinary people who lived and breathed the moments that shaped our world. We're not hemmed in by eras, borders, or religions. Instead, we seek out the tales of those who defied the odds and fought passionately for their beliefs. Whether they're right or wrong is up to you to decide. From Vercingetorix's doomed rebellion against Rome, to Osceola's unshakable war against the USA, all the way up to the inspiring Sobibor concentration camp uprising in World War II, each episode is an immersive listening experience, blending music and sound effects to really draw you into the story. Our episodes go for about 45 minutes, making them perfect for your commute, and are crafted using a wealth of historical sources, which I list on our website if you want to learn more. I'm the host, Elliot Gates, and I'm thrilled to have you joining me as we uncover history's hidden gems and illuminate the faded pages of our past. Look out for the Anthology of Heroes podcast on Spotify, Apple Music, or anywhere else you get your podcasts from.